It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Veronica Rickert is out today. Coming up at Central Time, we look at an ongoing review by the federal government looking at reported sexual assaults and how they were handled on the UW-Madison campus. First, a report shows that at least some inmates at the Waupun Correctional Institution weren't notified about changes to the state's solitary confinement policy. The Wisconsin Center for Investigative Journalism released the report, which says inmates agreed to sentences in solitary that are longer than the maximum terms under those recent changes. This isn't the first time there have been disputes between inmates and officers at the prison related to solitary confinement. In 2014, the center reported on multiple claims of abuse. Joining us now to give us the full story is Dee Hall, managing editor at the Wisconsin Center for Investigative Journalism. Dee, welcome back to Central Time.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Well, take us back to those changes. First of all, what did the state change when it came to solitary confinement last summer?
So the changes took effect on June 1st, and they were intended to dramatically lower the time, the maximum time in solitary that inmates would serve for disciplinary infractions. And so they went from 360 days maximum for an individual serious offense down to 90 days for the most serious offense. So it was cut very dramatically. In addition, the Department of Corrections decided that they would prefer to have correctional officers negotiating with inmates when there were disciplinary infractions to kind of speed up the process of reaching a disciplinary outcome.
Right, and that's a key part of the story here, because you write that inmates didn't know about this change, and that's important because they ultimately could be agreeing to the term of their solitary confinement, as I understand it.
Right, and that's what I found. I mean, this whole thing was sparked by an inmate's letter telling me that he was not aware that these maximum terms had been significantly reduced and that he had agreed to 6 months, in solitary for an infraction that, depending on how it was calculated, could have been significantly less.
This all comes against a backdrop of protests, of people rethinking the use of solitary confinement, not just in Wisconsin, but around the country. Is that what led to these changes in the first place?
Yeah, I think there's been a more soul-searching among Department of Corrections officials and certainly activists have been very vocal in this regard of feeling that this strategy for, you know, maintaining discipline and order in prisons is really tantamount in some cases to torture.
So walk us through the chain of events from Waupun. This change came into effect June 1st. Presumably,
right.
Prison officials around the state knew this was coming. What happened next? Why didn't this chain of information get to the inmates who I guess are supposed to know about this?
It's unclear to me why they did not, because the warden at Waupun at the time was actually on the task force that came up with these recommended changes. So it's surprising that that would be the one prison that I heard from that, in fact, where inmates said they were not notified. So June 1st is when these took effect. We did find the Department of Corrections did provide an email to me showing that the policy was sent for posting about 10 weeks later, mid-August, to Waupun. But I heard from two inmates after that time frame who said they were not notified, as of one of them as of the end of mid-September and the other one as of the beginning of October.
We're talking to Dee Hall from the Wisconsin Center for Investigative Journalism about solitary confinement in Wisconsin prisons, a change in policy. That change apparently didn't trickle down all the way to some inmates, leading to longer terms than are now allowed by law. So we actually saw inmates serving longer periods of time in solitary than these state guidelines allow. I mean, even if it was the situation where they were negotiating with correctional officers, in theory, that shouldn't have happened, right?
Well, in theory, no. But what I found was there were some inmates who agreed to times in solitary that were 2, 3, 4 times longer than under the new guidelines, which in one case, the new guidelines called for 30 days. One of the inmates had agreed to 120 days in segregation as a result of an infraction, which in this case was disobeying orders. That particular inmate, there were two separate disciplinary actions. Both of them exceeded the maximums on their face. I should say that there are both mitigating factors, meaning if you have history of mental illness, or if you complied with the order right away that a correctional officer gave, that can cut some of the time off there. Then there are aggravating factors. For example, if you're a multiple offender of a certain disciplinary rule, or what you did was particularly egregious. But the records don't show that either of those was taken into consideration in these voluntary agreements.
You're right about one inmate who, because he thought the maximum amount was 360 days, agreed to 180 days, not knowing that the actual limit was half that still.
Right, right. And his that's sort of what sparked all of this, because he said, I found out about this change reading some news coverage at the end of August. And at that point, he had been in solitary for many weeks. He had agreed, I believe it was sometime in mid-July, to this longer disposition, which he said he would not have done had he known that they had dramatically lowered the penalties.
Now, have you heard from either the Waupun facility or the Department of Corrections about what went wrong, why this guideline wasn't being followed?
No, I asked several times why the inmates were not notified in a timely fashion, was not given an answer, except that the correctional officers implemented, the staff implemented these changes, according to the Department of Corrections, but there was no mention made of inmate notification. I also asked if there were any steps taken to mitigate or to change these voluntary dispensations for inmates who were not aware of the new policy, and I got no response to that question.
So we don't know if things necessarily have changed in the last couple of months then?
I don't happen to know that.
A big picture, a solitary confinement, this change going on, a reduction, at least in theory, in the maximum amount of time an inmate can be in solitary confinement. The justification for solitary confinement is, hey, we need this for staff safety, or for the safety in many cases of other inmates. I know that's disputed by some research. But is there an instead now? Is there something that is being done to replace what would have been done when solitary confinement was used longer, a treatment or something?
I think one thing that they're trying to do, at least just at the start, is just to reduce the sheer amount of time that's spent in these isolating conditions, because there's a lot of research now that this can do much psychological harm. And so I think that is the first step here, where they're trying to make the time in solitary less, and as a result have fewer inmates spending time in solitary. And the policy appears to have worked to some extent, at least. The number of inmates at a point in time measurement at the beginning of 2015 who were in solitary was around 1,100. And when they did a point in time number at the end of 2015, it had gone down by about 200. So that's a significant reduction. Some of the other things that they're trying to do involve a little more access to some programming and things of that nature for people who are in these situations, in these settings.
One of the concerns about solitary confinement in Wisconsin was the potential for abuse of inmates. We talked to your colleague Bill Leaders back, I think it was in 2014, after a report he did on allegations of abuse by inmates against particular corrections officers. The Department of Corrections disputed a lot of the claims there. Can you remind us, though, what some of those claims were?
So, the Wisconsin Center for Investigative Journalism did a big investigation back in 2014. We had compiled just a surprising number of allegations of severe psychological and physical abuse that inmates were lodging against correctional officers and other staff at the prison there. And about two-thirds of the allegations involved a single correctional officer there at Waupun. And they followed a familiar pattern of inmates often being, manhandled, and in their words and their allegations, while they had handcuffs on and things of that nature. We have documented a history of at least allegations. And as you say, the Department of Corrections has essentially said that the inmates are lying about these allegations.
Big picture again, and this history is still kind of writing itself here, but given the protests you've seen, a movement on this issue from the Department of Corrections itself, are we seeing a change? Are we going to see more changes, do you think, in solitary confinement, the use of it?
I don't know if we'll see more in Wisconsin, but nationally there's definitely a movement. State after state is reducing the use of solitary because it doesn't help the inmates. It doesn't necessarily even help the institutions. It was supposed to keep order in the institutions, and you end up with some people who are pretty psychologically damaged as a result of this, and those people don't make good inmates either.
Dee, thanks a lot for joining us today.
All right, thanks a lot.
That's Dee Hall with the Wisconsin Center for Investigative Journalism talking about her new report on solitary confinement in Wisconsin prisons. Her piece is linked on the Central Time Facebook page. UW-Madison is under a federal review for its handling of three reported sexual assaults. This review follows complaints to the U.S. Department of Education Office of Civil Rights. That office said that opening a review does not indicate the merit of those complaints. Only four other universities in the country have as many active investigations of this type as UW-Madison. Here to talk with us now about these investigations is Milwaukee Journal Sentinel higher education reporter Karen Herzog. Karen, welcome back.
Thank you, Rob.
Well, what's the nature of these complaints? What do we know about what happened and what's involved in the investigation?
Well, the complaints themselves are not a matter of public record. You can see portions of them through the Freedom of Information Act, lots of redacting. But the gist of the complaints, and there are three against UW-Madison, two against UW-Whitewater, and one against the Medical College of Wisconsin. So UW-Madison is not the only one. But the nature is basically that they're looking at the handling by the universities or college, in the case of the medical college, or how they handled a complaint and whether the victim was subjected to, I guess, what's referred to as a sexually hostile environment because of the university failing to respond promptly or equitably. And the whole idea here is that under Title IX, universities that receive federal funding cannot discriminate on the basis of sex. In other words, they have to provide an education program that is conducive to both men and women. In this case, this is referring to the hostile environment with a sexual assault allegation.
And do you know what time period these complaints stem from?
Well, they vary in terms of when the incidents themselves occurred. The three at Madison, all three were filed, the complaints with the U.S. Department of Education, all three of those complaints were filed against the university this year. I think the most recent one was back in November.
And this is against a backdrop of national concerns, national attention on this issue of sexual assault and college campuses. Is this something that's come up that much here in Wisconsin in recent years until these recent complaints?
Well, I think that there's been more attention. As you mentioned, they're federal. There's been a lot of attention on the national level. Mm-hmm. And this whole notion of transparency and how universities handle these complaints. In 2011, there was a landmark. It was called the Dear Colleague Letter that was issued by the Department of Education, and that was intended to guide universities in the handling of sexual violence complaints. And UW's system specifically has been working to rewrite the state statute about non-academic misconduct codes. But basically, that statute, the non-academic misconduct code, is not in compliance with this Dear Colleague Letter, in that the complainant and the accused don't have the same rights. The accused can have an appeal for whatever sanction is handed down by university, whether that be a suspension or expulsion, but the complainant has no right to appeal whatever that decision is.
So it seems like there's kind of a conflict, two different systems of investigating a sexual assault here. One is the legal system, where someone is innocent until proven guilty. They would be tried in a court of law. And then the university has some responsibility, as you just said, to both parties, the accused, but also the accuser. And against that innocent until proven guilty, there's the idea of protecting the rights of the potential victim. Is that part of the tension here?
Yes, absolutely. There's a big question about whether this is the role of a university, because universities have no legal authority to compel evidence. And so the burden of proof is different, and there's also a lot at stake when you think about the punishment could be an expulsion from a university. That's a pretty big mark on someone's academic record, and if you don't prove it to the preponderance of evidence that a criminal court system would require, that person can come back to the university and sue them and say that they've been, you know, that their reputation has been harmed by something that was never proven.
We're talking with Karen Herzog from the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel about sexual assault on college campuses, current Office of Civil Rights investigations of UW-Madison and a couple other Wisconsin campuses. They're going through the system now. So what are the differences in how a university, maybe under the UW system plan, and a police department would handle a report, an allegation of sexual assault?
Well, a police department obviously would have, as I mentioned, they can compel, well, I guess the district attorney's office would compel evidence for the case of a court hearing or a trial. But there's a lot more ability in the criminal court system to actually process an alleged crime in a way that the burden of proof is greater. Many would argue that that's where these cases belong. But in the case of university, they view this as conduct, whether a student has been involved in misconduct. And university officials will tell you where they think they can be most effective because they don't have police detectives to ferret out the evidence, that they can be most effective in educating students about consent. You know, what is consent? It's not the absence of a no, it's the presence of an absolute yes. Clear yes. And so teaching students about that is something they think they can be most effective in doing. And there's also a campaign that says that the bystanders have a responsibility when you're at a party, if you see somebody who's drunk and you think they're, you know, in danger of not being able to make good choices, that there are different things that you can do to intervene and help protect them.
One of the concerns that I've seen come up in Wisconsin and elsewhere is the notion that the survivor of a sexual assault, if the alleged perpetrator isn't convicted or charged, might face the circumstance of going to class and seeing the assailant there, or seeing them in the dorm or other cafeteria, other places on the university campus, making a hostile environment for the victim.
Mm-hmm. And I think that's part of where the university's involvement comes into play. And one could make the argument that perhaps it is legitimate that a university should be able to say, okay, there is a complaint against you, you're to have no contact with this individual, or to place them in different classes. But there again, you know, how can, you know, it's often a he said, she said thing. But under Title IX, it is supposed to be a situation where anyone can go to a university and sit in a classroom and not be subjected to a hostile environment. So there is a certain responsibility on the part of the university. And it is a challenge for victims and for the accused to navigate all of the things that happen once a complaint has been filed.
You mentioned that the UW system's guidelines on this issue, or the ones they've been working on, are out of step with that letter from the Department of Education. How so?
It's in the case of the biggest thing that I'm aware of is just the rights that the accused and the accuser have. And this is just a matter of updating the statute, and currently I believe that it's on the governor's desk, and it would still go through, I think, like a legislative committee just for a passive review. But this is something that will be system-wide. Now, UW-Madison has actually changed its rules pending that type of action to give the accused and the accuser the same rights of appeal in a case of a hearing where there's a sanction that's determined. And, you know, if the accuser says, well, gee, you know, I don't think this is the proper finding, that person can appeal it, as in addition to the accused being able to appeal it. Now, in the last 5 years, I think there's only been a handful of expulsions. That doesn't happen very often.
Now, for this Office of Civil Rights Department of Education investigation, what's involved in that? What are they looking at? What, if anything, can they do to I guess, punish a university if it's not in compliance?
I think part of it is just holding them accountable. So what they do is they send a letter to the university president or the chancellor, and they say, okay, here's all of the things we want to see. They want to see all email communications between university officials and perhaps the students. They want all records of what were the conversations that took place between the accuser and, you know, say, an advocate that the university has, or the dean of students or someone in the dean of students' office. They basically review all, you know, the paper trail, everything, and they also do interviews to talk with them about how they've handled things. And perhaps the outcome would be to say, well, you have to change this policy and this. You have to do this differently. And then they would monitor them to see how well they do in terms of improving their practices.
You mentioned the issue of transparency, it being a concern that universities handle these allegations of sexual assault with some measure of transparency. That's got to run up against, though, protecting the privacy of people directly involved in any given case. Is that creating trouble for university administrators?
Well, it does and it doesn't. You're right that the privacy must be protected, and that does happen. But I think the bigger issue here is that there's been this sense that universities have not, because there is the protection of the person's identity, that they haven't necessarily been as aggressive in dealing with these issues. The whole notion of binge drinking in Wisconsin is huge, and quite often alcohol is involved in these sexual assaults. and quite often it's a friend. So there are different things that a university can do in terms of being out front, educating students, making it very clear that this kind of behavior is not acceptable. Those are the kinds of things that, you know, you talk about accountability and transparency. These types of investigations force that.
And do you see that being a priority here in Wisconsin for university administrators trying to prevent this problem before it becomes an issue of trying to assess guilt or innocence?
Well, back in September, UW-Madison participated in a national survey that was really interesting and basically asked, you know, students who participated, and it was roughly a 22% response rate, have you ever been sexually assaulted? And the findings for Madison were a little bit more than for the rest of the country. It was 1 in 4 female undergrads who were in the survey who said that they had been sexually assaulted. And the university looked at that as well as the alcohol consumption indication and said, gee, you know, we do have to, there's more that we do have to do. And so they're talking about different things they could do, like they have something, they have a survey that it's called Tonight. It's a prevention program.
We'll leave it there for now. Thanks to Karen Herzog, higher education reporter at the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Veronica Rickert is out today. On Martin Luther King Jr. Day, people around the state and the nation are looking back at Dr. King's legacy and the way he changed the world. Earlier today on Wisconsin Public Radio, we heard a live broadcast of the state's annual ceremony over at the Capitol building. Now we'll take a look at modern-day civil rights protests, especially the Black Lives Matter movement, and how it fits into the history of civil rights here in the U.S. The Black Lives Matter movement started in 2012 after George Zimmerman was acquitted after the shooting of African-American Trayvon Martin. The activist movement gained national attention during protests following the deaths of Michael Brown in Ferguson, Missouri, and Eric Garner in New York City. Here in Wisconsin, the Black Lives Matter movement held demonstrations in Madison after a white police officer shot and killed Tony Robinson, an unarmed African-American 17-year-old. Chad Dion Lasseter is with us now to put the movement into the larger historical context of civil rights in the United States. He's a national expert on race relations and a professor at the University of Pennsylvania. Chad, welcome back to Central Time.
Thank you for having me, and happy MLK Day to you and your listening audience.
Well, and to you as well. So on MLK Day, talk about the Black Lives Matter movement. Big picture, how do you see it fitting in the progression of the civil rights movement?
I think what we see is the progression of the Black Lives Matter movement being that similar to when we had the SNCC organization, when we had the CORE organization, and most of these movements started and were galvanized by young people. And so when we see Black Lives Matter, it's connected out of that tradition where a lot of these young people on college campuses, be it Missouri, be it Oklahoma, be it all over the United States of America, have grandparents and have parents and loved ones in their communities who came out of the civil rights movement. I think what we've also seen of that is evolved beyond just the police brutality that we've observed over the past 2 years. We've also seen discussion around, you know, working wages as well as spatial segregation and gentrification.
Now, a lot of people point to Black Lives Matter as kind of this leaderless movement that springs up in places spontaneously or with very local leaders. I've seen it contrasted to the leadership of Martin Luther King back in the day, and other people saying, hold on, he was a leader, a main leader, but there were lots of other people. Some of them we remember their names, some of them we don't.
No, I think you're absolutely right. You had Bayard Rustin, you had A. Philip Randolph. You also had a lot of sexism in the sense that during that time, a lot of the black leaders specifically did not allow the voices for women leaders to emerge. But you also had our colleagues on the other side of the color line. And that's one thing that we need to point out right here in this contemporary era is that Black Lives Matter doesn't need a particular leader. It's shared leadership.
So what do you see as the main feature of Black Lives Matter? Is it the protests? Is it the social media? Is it the issues they're selecting? Where do you see the key to understanding Black Lives Matter?
I understand it from the context, first and foremost, that Black Lives Matter in the sense of a philosophical aspect of police brutality by some police officers who are killing black males and black people with impunity. A lot of African Americans in their communities see the police as a occupying terroristic force that sanctions killing. This is not my narrative, but this is the narrative from a lot of the communities that I'm doing ethnography in and sociology in, as well as anthropology. I think the Black Lives Matter is trying to speak back to those challenges. And then it also expands into the aspect of looking at gentrification in various urban areas. So, for instance, here in the city of Philadelphia, we see a lot of gentrification in communities where black people, brown people, and white people reside. I think it's trying to speak back to some of those challenges. It's not saying that Black Lives Matter from a superiority standpoint over police lives or all lives. It's just saying, please see my humanity in the midst of some of the tragedies that we see with these police shootings.
Looking at how some things haven't changed, I saw somebody had cited a portion from the famous I Have a Dream speech by Dr. King, and he says in the speech, no black person should be, quote, the victim of the unspeakable horrors of police brutality. So this is not an issue that's new somehow in the 21st century.
No, it's not. And I think that, and I'm glad you pointed that out, we tend to forget that king who spoke about the triple evils. He talked about the triple evils being that of militarism, racism, and poverty. He goes from a Nobel Peace Prize winning king to speaking out against the Vietnam War. He goes from Man of the Year from Time Magazine to giving a great speech entitled A Time to Break Silence, Why I Oppose the Vietnam War. And so King talks about some of the challenges that happened that got him into the jail in Birmingham, where he writes the letter from a Birmingham jail. And so I think we can't dismiss that, that during the Civil Rights Movement, we had our Jewish colleagues, our white colleagues, who saw the humanity and joined with black humanity, and they also were the victims of the Freedom Rides and the bombing and the killing and the police brutality as well.
Talking to Chad Dion Laster from the University of Pennsylvania, looking at the civil rights history and where Black Lives Matter fits into it on this Martin Luther King Jr. holiday. Let's get into, you alluded to this earlier, Chad, the Black Lives Matter versus All Lives Matter debate, a controversy, I guess, some people saying, by saying Black Lives Matter, are you saying other lives don't matter? What do you make of that back and forth we've been seeing over the last year and a half or so?
That's a misnomer, and I think that the individuals who coined the phraseology from a philosophy and political standpoint of Black Lives Matter is not dismissing the lives of others. In our society, if we look at it historically, from slavery to, you know, Reconstruction to Jim Crow to the Constitution of three-fifths, the humanity of black people has not always been embraced by the American democracy. And so Black Lives Matter is simply saying that our lives matter, and it's also saying that the black-on-black violence, if we want to use that term, because King said the greatest purveyor of violence is our United States government, but blacks are not okay with, you know, the crime that happens in their communities as well. And so we see the humanity of others. We're just simply saying, you know, Black Lives Matter, stop killing us in the manner that the killings have occurred with Trayvon Martin and many others. And so it's not dismissing anyone. You'll never, ever come across a time where black people in America have positioned themselves as a people from a superiority standpoint. It just has never happened, and it never will.
And you just touched on another critique often of Black Lives Matter, with critics saying, hey, focus on the killing of black people by other black people. That's a more common problem than police killings. Is it possible to do both?
I think it is the possibility to do both, but I don't want Black Lives Matter activists who are on the ground, who are doing this from a grassroots standpoint, to focus on that. There's enough of us who can focus on that. I want them to focus on the issue at hand so that we don't start mixing those issues. The issue at hand is some police officers who do not see the humanity of black males and black people and will kill them with impunity. When you have individuals like the young man in Chicago who was wielding a small knife, what we need is training for mental health first aid. We don't need to have him killed. And then you have these narratives where other individuals on the other side of the color line have committed crimes that we say, well, listen, the police didn't take them out. Dylan Roof, for one, in South Carolina, goes into a church, kills nine people. He walks out of that church. He goes to jail. And so we're not saying that we want white people killed. We're not saying that we want black people killed. We're not saying all cops, but we definitely want to say that there is something that's going on as it relates to the tension in the communities between some police officers and some people in the African-American community.
Now, the Black Lives Matter is the most visible civil rights activism movement maybe in the country today. It's not the only one. There's still a lot of, I guess what we could call more traditional organizations that maybe are carrying on work that started in the 50s and 60s. How do you see those doing maybe the same mission in different ways, or maybe different missions in different ways? Do they come into conflict with each other?
I don't think they come into conflict with each other, but you definitely have the ACLU. You have those organizations that are looking at mass incarceration reform. I was down in Washington, D.C. last year doing some stuff with Van Jones, Newt Gingrich, and Senator Cory Booker around bringing some attention to, you know, the sentencing disparities. I think you also have the ADL. You have a lot of organizations that are working, NAACP, Urban League, and just various organizations on every side of the color line, whether it's working for migrant and immigrant rights. And I think one of the things that we sometimes get caught up in is thinking that, you know, we can't partner with each other. And so if you look at Cal Berkeley, when these police shootings have taken place at the University of Cal Berkeley, you've had students who were white who were saying Black Lives Matter over in Asia, and a lot of our Asian American Pacific Islander communities. There are people who are holding signs saying Black Lives Matter as well, Brazil, over in Japan. And so I think it's just one of those things where we have to realize that this is a pivotal time where we have to figure out how we can coexist and be tolerant towards each other.
We're talking to national race relations expert Chad Dion Lassiter about how the Black Lives Matter movement fits into the historical context of civil rights here in the United States. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What's your view? What do you think of the Black Lives Matter movement? Have you participated in it in some way or another? How do you think it fits into the larger picture, the history of civil rights in the U.S.? What do you think of that name, Black Lives Matter? And has it started conversations in your own community? Call in now at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or share your thoughts on the Central Time Facebook page. We're picking up our discussion now with Chad Dion Lassiter, professor at the University of Pennsylvania and national expert on race relations, talking about how the Black Lives Matter movement fits into the larger picture of civil rights in the United States. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What do you think Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. would have said about the Black Lives Matter movement? How do you think it fits into the big picture of civil rights? What do you think it's accomplishing? Call in now at 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page. We'll go right to a caller. We've got Amy on the line in Milwaukee. Amy, hi.
Hi. My name is Amy, and I'm actually from Chicago. And one thing that I've been frustrated with, and I'm interested in how this movement can help address it, is that it seems like the defense a lot of the time with police officers or in the Trayvon Martin situation, the gentleman who shot him, is that they were scared because of their kind of inherent racism. And it seems like people sympathize with that and say, oh, I understand why he reacted that way, because he saw this person he thinks is a thug. And so it makes sense that he shot him. And so I guess it's just, I'm interested in such a complex topic and how a movement like Black Lives Matter could address that.
Amy, thanks for that call. And Chad, I've seen this come up, the idea that not just police officers, many people see young black male and think threat. And maybe it's not even a conscious thought out thought that makes that happen. It's almost a developed, learned response now.
Yeah, I don't think Black Lives Matter, the way I view them, are able to address that. I think the way that we're able to address that is to continue to do anti-racism training, diversity training, and multiculturalism training all over the country, whether that be in our college classrooms with mandatory courses, whether that's in community centers, whether that's providing books, whether that's just having frank conversations in our catchment areas in Chicago, in Philadelphia, New York, suburban areas, rural areas, urban areas where we just simply talk about the humanity of people and not seeing them from the racial lens or the racial contract of boogeyman, stereotypical, that's deeply rooted in the psyche of our democracy. I also want to be clear that and Amy asks, she poses a great question. I want to be very clear in saying that I don't think that Black Lives Matter rivals the civil rights movement. I think that Black Lives Matter is needed for this pivotal time that we find ourselves in. If Dr. King was here today, he would say that it has to be sustainable efforts. Black Lives Matter, that movement is still in the infancy stage, hopefully giving birth to something. But the civil rights movement cannot be compared to the Black Lives Matter movement simply because the civil rights movement addressed laws. It addressed legislation. It got bills passed. It was protracted. It was deeply entrenched. Speaking back to some of the suffering that people saw during that time.
Amy, thanks for that call at 800-642-1234. We'll go next to Joel in Minneapolis. Joel, hi.
Hi. I want to say thanks for having me on. It's a pleasure. So I study political science at the University of Minnesota up in Minneapolis, and I just recently took a class on social movement, and they were discussing how a lot of the civil rights movement, how many of their protests were very planned out and very precise. Particularly with Rosa Parks, they chose her specifically because she was a little less dark and appealed to more of the population. I was just wondering if you think that the Black Lives Matter was, you could foresee them making more planned protests rather than, it seems like they're all reactionary at this point, forming more of a, coercive, just planned protests rather than these reactionary protests.
Interesting question, Joel. So the civil rights movements of the 50s and 60s, he's saying, and accurately saying, as I understand it, very planned out, very strategic in a lot of ways. Do you see anything comparable to that with the Black Lives Matter movement?
Not at the present time. I think the only thing that may be comparative to that would be the die-ins that they've done. But Joel is absolutely right that during the Freedom Rides, they would sit down and they would role-play what could possibly and potentially happen if you were at a Woolworth counter. What would happen if a police did allow a German Shepherd to bite you, and how to protect yourself from brutality. And so he's absolutely right that a lot of those social movements, be it the Red Movement with the Native Americans, really was about strategies and tactics. I think that there are aspects of the Black Lives Matter movement around the country where there are tactics, there are strategies, there are shared leaderships, there are meetings taking place. I think in the public sphere, because we don't see those meetings, does not mean that they're not taking place. But he's absolutely right that there has to have strategy. And history shows us that the strategies and the tactics and being calculated in your proactive civil disobedient protest in the spirit of Martin Luther King is what's advantageous for any movement.
Joel, thanks for that call. We'll go next to Mary in Green Bay. Mary, hi.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I currently attend Wisconsin University in a rural part of Wisconsin, and watching the Black Lives Matter movement on our campus, how radicalized it's becoming, not only with our African American students, but also white, the Asian population, everyone, they're becoming so focused on that, they're not actually trying to make a difference almost. They're just trying to show that almost like they're more important than other cultures, no matter actually what culture it is, whether it's just African Americans or not. And it's interesting to compare it to the civil rights movement and how, like the previous caller was saying, how there were strategies, how they actually there are meetings, and in the public sphere, there isn't a lot of that going on or being shown, at least. So,
Mary, thanks a lot for the call. So she's saying these movements, Black Lives Matter, too radical, rubbing people the wrong way. Chad, what do you make of that?
I would say the civil rights movement was radical and rubbed people the wrong way because it was going against the maintenance of the status quo and speaking back to some of the white supremacy policies that gave us institutional racism, which were prejudice plus power. The Birmingham bus boycott was not about people not solely just being on the bus. It was a policy that said you had to get on the bus, pay your fare, get off, give a seat up to a white person. I think that when we see structured protests, it looks like Missouri, in which the president is no longer there. It looks like what the students did at Princeton University and addressing some of the challenges with Woodrow Wilson's name being on the building. And so I hear her point, but I think that radical does not mean that we should be afraid. And once again, if the Black Lives Matter movement was centered around superiority, I would be vocal and speaking out against it. I don't think it comes from that perspective.
Mary, thanks for that call. We're talking to Chad Dion Laster from the University of Pennsylvania, looking at the Black Lives Matter movement and its place so far in American civil rights history. And Chad, following up more on that point, the idea of how civil the civil rights movement should be. Obviously, as you just said, Dr. King led very disruptive protests, which is the point. Some people reacted. They thought he didn't go far enough, that it was too peaceful, the peaceful protests that he did. The Black Panther movement, Malcolm X, and others. This is a long-running debate over how civil rights protesters should behave in public, hasn't it?
Yeah, it really is, and it's historical. And we look at that historical trajectory. We didn't see black people attacking white people. What we saw was the police taking fire hoses, and those hoses were sprayed on individuals. We also saw German shepherds biting the breasts of white women and black women. We saw Bloody Sunday coming over the Edmund Pettus Bridge. And so even with the Black Lives Matter movement, we don't see any attacks on white people, nor should we. We don't see any attacks on police. What we see is people using their voices, people being upset over what they view as a cover-up. If you look at Chicago and the film that was, you know, covered up for an entire year, once again, me being an African-American, I'm also able to be objective. And so I am concerned about some of the challenges in our community, some of the pathology in our community. But I almost also go from a professional standpoint and simply verbalize that at the end of the day, black people are not okay with other black people committing crime and not saying anything in their communities. But I think the dynamic changes when you see the police. See, the police are supposed to uphold the law. They're supposed to protect. And it seems like where we're at in this era, they're protecting some people and then they're killing others.
Briefly, as we wrap up, Chad, what are you watching for in 2016 with Black Lives Matter and civil rights?
I'm hoping that they learn from some of those leaders from the past. I'm hoping that they're open to learn from some of those leaders of the past. And I hope that they truly embark upon expanding this to a national dialogue. And in the spirit of Martin Luther King, I'm hoping that they study King and notice that in studying King, that you have to do it by building coalitions on every side of the gender line and on every side of the color line.
Chad, thanks as always for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
That was Chad Dion Laster, national expert on race relations and professor at the University of Pennsylvania. He was with us to talk about how the Black Lives Matter movement fits into the larger picture of civil rights in the United States on this Martin Luther King Jr. holiday. Weekday mornings from 6 to 9, it's the Joy Cardine Show. Tomorrow morning after 6, Why We Snap. Joy talks to an expert on the brain about why we lose our tempers and how to control our rage. That's tomorrow morning after 6 on the Ideas Network. Well, a Wisconsin landmark was all the rage in 2015. New numbers out for a unique piece of Wisconsin transportation history, the Merrimack Ferry. According to the Department of Transportation, over 302,000 vehicles took the trip across the Wisconsin River between Sauk and Columbia counties. The ferry, the Merrimack Ferry, it's part of the Wisconsin road system. So you're on the road while you're on the water. It's part of Highway 113. As I understand it, it's the state's only free car ferry. It ran longer than usual, by the way, in December, thanks to that warm winter. Remember that, when it was a warm winter? Still didn't break records, though. The biggest number I found was 318,000 vehicles back in 2009. Now, I didn't get out on the ferry in 2015. It's definitely a unique Wisconsin tradition that I love. I like getting the kids waiting for the ferry, having some ice cream at that shop by the launch on either side, and the mellow cruise, very short cruise, between the towns of Merrimack and Oakey. Now, if this has you feeling nostalgic and you want to hit the water, don't. Ferry's closed for the season. Wait for a few months. But if you're a fan of the Merrimack Ferry, share your memories on the Central Time Facebook page. Send us a message there or tweet us at Central Time WPR. Stick around. There's more to come on Central Time here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.